right, you Victoria Day weekending accursed. Yep, we're recording this pod bright and early on Victoria Day Monday, National Patriots Day if you live in Quebec, because this panel just straight refuses to take a fucking holiday when there's politics to break down. Scott Reed is here. Corey Tenike is here, lamenting this first official day of the end of the turtleneck season. Jordan Leibnitz is here. And you know me, David Hurley. So let's get to it, because the coals are lit, the pork shoulder is spiced, and my bottle of Lemon Heart rum isn't going to drink itself. So, Alberta goes to the polls in just 7 days. We'll look at Smith and Notley's debate performances last week and talk about closing message strategy for both. And then it's all things David Johnson. If he recommends an inquiry, how should the government frame and manage comms? If he recommends against, how does the government and the opposition respond? Our cursed clipping this week is Rob Benzie and Rob Ferguson in the Toronto Star on the Stellantis deal and the links with Highway 413, a story that feels like it's only going to get bigger. And then it's the voice of the great Gordon Pinsent calling from somewhere in the cosmos for our Hey Yous. Jordan, Scott, Corey, what are you doing other than this today on Victoria Day? Jordan, what do you got going on today?
Well, a little bit of gardening, and yesterday my family and I, we went to go and feed the mosquitoes at a provincial park and did the first of the season jumping in the lake, so it is officially summer. It's great. Oh, I'm pretty stoked.
Awesome. Yeah, my dog went for a swim yesterday, but I was too afraid to. It's still a little
cold. It's a good way to really feel alive. I would recommend it.
Jordan, by the way, for those of you watching on the YouTube machine, has glitchy internet because she does not use TELUS. She uses some other provider.
My nonprofit internet provider is fantastic.
Corey, you're in Ottawa today like it's a work day or something.
Yeah, well, I came into the office because it's a little noisy at the condo this time of day, but... Yeah, we're going to have some fun today. I'm going to take my boys to some friends of ours who are opening up a restaurant in Stittsville. And so they're going to earn a little money on Victoria Day, sanding and priming walls and doing stuff like that. So excellent. it should be a fun day.
Is this the moment, David, where I should jump in and tell everybody that I used to work drywall in the summers to try to pretend that I have a large streak of masculinity still lurking within me somewhere? Yeah, we board the walls. I never like to tape them. I just like to board them. I'd put them up by nail. Of course, it's the days before a nail gun, so you'd have to put it in, pop in a pin with your hand, then hammer it in afterward. And you just get those sheets. I tell you, I could do a whole house, 2,400 square feet, in about 6 hours if I was really cranking. And then I'd stop for a case of beer, and I would shake that dry dust off me just like a goddamn calendar of cowboys. That's exactly how I looked. Tough guy.
All of this is a bunch of lies, because the concept of you doing anything around the house makes me think of Michael Keaton and Mr. Mom.
Right? Nice contemporary reference. You might as well be talking about Buster Keaton. Fuck your old.
Are you wiring that with 220? 220, 221, whatever it takes. Okay. Alberta election. The debate came and went this week. As usual, the pundits don't know what happened in a debate. So we're waiting on the next Janet Brown poll to tell us whether anybody broke through or not in that debate. But my feeling was that there was no joy in NDP Mudville after that debate. Not that Notley got beaten, but that she didn't win and maybe had to win. So as we enter the final week, I don't know, the whole feeling about this thing, maybe it was all set by that Janet Brown poll or whatever, but the whole feeling of this thing is that Smith is going to win, and that Notley's going to have to come from behind in this last week if she's going to win. Jordan, do you agree with that assessment? And if so, what does Notley need to do to close this out?
I don't want to agree.
I know you don't want to agree.
I really don't want to agree. Yeah, I think the debate, I mean, Danielle Smith as a career TV presenter, obviously that served her really well there. And I think that if that was the only Danielle Smith that voters saw, then they saw somebody who looked very competent and sane. And, you know, even if she was scripted within an inch of her life, that's probably the very best way for her to be. I think Notley's best, like her best moments in the debate actually were when she was talking about education. Like she had a great kind of connect moment there I might have wished for more of those from her, because I think that's where she shines, you know. And there was maybe a little bit of a tendency to pull too much into the wonky territory that I think is a comfort zone.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I also don't know that debate, like, there wasn't one key defining moment, so I'm not. It didn't provide that amazing shift like they saw in 2015, which is, I think, a lot of people were going into it hoping for that. So that means that as the NDP moves into the last week, like, I think they've got to do three things. They've got to grab the undecideds that are still out there, probably with a little bit more of a forward-looking vision. What is the stuff that these people are going to get if they vote NDP to help with any reluctance that they might have about voting for Notley? And then they've got to suppress the UCP vote. They have to keep those voters home. They have to make it embarrassing and costly to vote for Danielle Smith. And so that means they've got to ramp up the negatives about Smith and her record and what she's hiding. And I think you're going to see a lot of talk about a hidden agenda in the coming week from the NDP, and that'll be with the intent of keeping those voters home. And then they have to all guns blazing. Can I ask you,
why wouldn't that have been a good setup for the debate?
Hmm.
Why wouldn't they have wanted to set her up to have to talk about CPP and have to talk about RCMP and stuff like that in the debate?
Yeah, I think that for sure there would be moments where maybe that could have been done in the debate, but I think that there's also a strategic choice. Like, Notley going into the debate kind of, I think, had to choose between being relatable and being on the offensive. And you don't necessarily get to do both. Mm-hmm. And so her team chose relatable, and I think that was the right choice because of who they need to reach. Like, for those undecided voters that they need to reach, that was the right move. I mean, as a partisan, I think sitting here, I wanted her to be punching. I wanted her to be sharp. But that is not most people, right? So there are other voices out there who can do that for the NDP. And I think that's what you're going to see this week. I think you're going to see surrogates out there carrying that message. Well, Notley focuses on a more positive closing message that's really targeted quite directly at those undecideds in the key ridings.
Cool. Scott, you watched the debate. What did you think of it? And is it too late for Notley to do something new, or do they just do what they've been doing with more intensity in this last week?
Well, let me start by saying that I want Notley to win, right? So, I mean, I really want her to win, mostly because I really want Danielle Smith to lose, and I want all that politics. I want someone's manifest unfitness for office to matter. It just startles me. And it doesn't seem to. It doesn't seem to matter that much. It doesn't seem to matter enough, which I think is, in a nutshell, why the NDP don't appear to be winning, although it's obviously very close, but they don't appear to have taken the campaign. So, I mean, I thought about the debate itself, I thought that Smith won. I thought, frankly, on my scorecard, and I was looking for reasons to conclude otherwise, but I thought that she did three things really effectively. First of all, as Jordan hinted, she's just a superior performer. She looked very comfortable on camera. She's very conversational. She doesn't sound crazy. So if you spent the campaign saying she's crazy, she doesn't look crazy, doesn't behave crazy. When she's scripted, she's talking about, you know, sort of an acceptable range of issues. And so she doesn't sound like the person who's talking on the phone to Arthur Pulaski. She's just a good, strong performer. And Notley looked nervous. And I just don't, you know, that contrast was bad. If you did the old sound off test, it was really bad because I think Notley didn't look as strong. Second, she owned the economy. Smith did. She consistently and persistently kept bringing it back to the economy, which I don't think is ever a bad thing. Notley doesn't go there for obvious reasons. I think it's poor ground for her. And then third, I think that Smith was very, very effective in, she had a strategy beyond just those things. It wasn't a passive strategy of, I'll just stick to my issues. She consistently wedded Notley to Trudeau. She barely ever mentioned Notley without reinforcing that she and Trudeau were together in some grand conspiracy to destroy the economic history, fortunes, legacy, and future of Alberta. And I thought that she did that with effect. And I thought that the NDP campaign could have seen that for coming and have done things to forestall it. I mean, what do you do in the next week? I think the challenge of the NDP campaign, and maybe I'll be proven wrong. I'd be happily proven wrong. I'd be happily receiving telegrams from a victorious NDP campaign saying, think you know so much, you fucker? Ha, 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 we won. But I think...
I just interrupt you for a second. If I was them and I was winning, I don't think I would want people to know.
For sure.
I actually had polling that showed that I was winning today, I don't think I would tell anybody.
No, I think that's right. This is one of those campaigns where if you were winning, you need to sneak it in under the radar. But I guess my impulse in terms of the week ahead is I think the challenge for them is that their data probably has been telling them that, you know, if you look at what they've done, prove that Smith is unfit, and use their own words and videotape against him, which they did with great effect. Their war room was very effective first half of the campaign, middle of the campaign. And then secondly, hammer and hammer and hammer on health. And I think that what we've seen is that two-seam fastball hasn't been enough to win the game. And so they need one more pitch. And I hear what Jordan is saying, have other surrogates come out and all that stuff. But I just don't know that you can sit back and rely on the hope that surrogates will be effective and targeted enough and that they'll land loudly enough that will do your dirty work for you. And then you can just make the closing argument. I just don't think you have the luxury of that. I think you have to get in there understanding the risks. But I think in the last campaign, you got to throw a slider. You got to throw a sinker. You got to see which one of these pitches can work and which one gets them swinging. And so I would be going after the CPP. You know, I've been harping on that for a long time. I think it's too late to play the whole arena thing. It would just look crass and manufactured now. So is there an issue that feels like it's relatively new to the discussion that you could light them up in the last week? I think I would go CPP, CPP, CPP and make the link to this is why you can't. If she's going to lie to Arthur Pawlowski or lie to us or lie to everyone, she's sure as shit going to lie to us about the CPP and can't be trusted with the CPP. Don't. And I think one of the other possible attractiveness about that issue, attractive features of that issue, is that I've seen polling which suggests that it depresses UCP enthusiasm. Like a lot of the UCP voters are older and they do not like the sound of fucking with their pension. And so maybe you have a bonus effect if you don't just take charge of an issue and light people up, but that it maybe has a discouraging effect on UCP core voters and it leaves them a little less. Well, you know what? Me and Gladys didn't bother to vote this year.
Yeah, I think that going after the pension issue makes a lot of sense. For those of us who've never lived through one, I've got to believe when people hear wildfires, it conjures a broad image of immense blazes with a generalized sense of devastation. I guess what I'm saying is most of us have little conception of the thousands of ways, community by community, wildfires destroy infrastructure and turn lives upside down. Beyond the firefighting teams, it takes so, so many volunteers to help support and restore some sense of normalcy. What I'd like to do here is recognize team members and retirees from our presenting sponsor, TELUS, who are on the ground right now helping communities ravaged by fires across Alberta in just about every way you can imagine. Hurly-burlyites, here are just two examples among many. In Rainbow Lake, northwest of the province, the cell tower site lost its power, which meant absolutely no wireless service in Fort Nelson, BC, for key relief operations like the RCMP, CN Rail, and the hospital. Oh, and the single in-and-out road was closed because fire was on the doorstep. Alberta Wildlife Relief came through with a Puma Superlift chopper to fly in a huge trailer generator. TELUS technicians were also helicoptered in to connect the thing under some pretty dire circumstances, restoring service in Rainbow Lake and bringing Fort Nelson back online. Heading due south from there, over 800 people were evacuated from Sturgeon Lake Cree First Nation, many not having homes to return to because they were either gone or too badly burned. Darren Ketlow, TELUS's Indigenous Connectivity Relationship Lead, reached out immediately and with the help of a number of other TELUS team members, delivered on a long list of essential supplies. Trucks with food, water, disaster kits, diapers, and so much more were sent to the Grand Prairie Friendship Center, an evac site for Sturgeon Lake Cree and other Indigenous communities in the region. On top of that, they initiated a clothing drive to support the thousands displaced in surrounding communities. Large or small, it's these acts of kindness from people who care that make a difference. The TELUS team will continue to be there for as long as it takes. Corey, I'm interested in your take because, to be honest, you've been pretty candid on this show over time that you don't think Smith is a conservative, first of all, and second of all, that you don't think she's terribly competent. So why is she winning? If she's winning, but why, let's say, why is she close or winning at this stage?
Well, I think it's because the basic core narrative is much more saleable. And it's around the economy. It's around what is the future of the energy industry in Alberta and the associated real estate value in Calgary and the general employment environment. And I think,
in the NDP, you're playing defense on that, all of that, right? All of that.
All of that. And Notley is married to the term just transition as much as anyone can get married to a term. Like the number of quotes that they have of her talking about that, and that's been pounding away in the advertising, is death by association to two things. One, Justin Trudeau, who's the least popular politician probably in the history of man in the province of Alberta. And
more popular than his dad ever was, oddly.
Which is surprising because that was the high watermark before. That's the person in number two slot in that province. So, but like the core narrative is not that sellable. It's nuanced. It's doesn't have an intuitive ring of truth in terms of what Notley's talking about around just transition, etc. It's all very nuanced, and it's in a topic area where the NDP have a massive issue deficit, which is the economy, and so. In a campaign, like if we're going into this and say, okay, the campaign's going to predominantly be about the economy, that's going to be the number one issue in terms of what people are being able to push in front of voters, then, I think we'd all agree, advantage UCP. Like, that's the narrative you want to be on. I think that's fundamentally what's winning it. I think with respect to the debate, and we've talked about this a little bit before, with the comparisons to 2015 federally, but if you're going to make leadership and leadership competence and leadership ability the central theme of your campaign, and this is what Harper tried to do in 2015, it's what Notley's been trying to do in this election, then you really have to demonstrate that gap in opportunities like the one television debate. And, I think it was a Smith win in terms of the debate. I don't think by a huge margin, but I think she won. And if you're going to have it on leadership and competence and all that stuff, like Notley must win that debate, and I'm afraid she didn't. And whether it was nerves or what, she stumbled in her opening. She looked shaky and uneven compared to Smith. You can't have that. If your ballot question is supposed to be leadership and competence, you better show you're a fucking leader and be competent.
I also think I think it's really crazy to have that ethics finding dropping on the same day as the debate and how that played into things, both in terms of the debate kind of hiding that story and also how it could be used, it could have been used in the debate itself, I think is a really interesting question. Like in any other campaign, that would have been such a landmine. But in this absolutely insane campaign, it was just, a Tuesday. Right.
Feels baked.
What about Scott's point, though? What about Scott's initial point? Has the standards for candidates dropped so precipitously that none of this shit matters that much anymore?
I think it's more to Corey's point that it's baked in for some of those voters now. People who are voting for Danielle Smith after everything that has come out and everything that has been said already clearly have a tolerance for this kind of crap from her.
But why?
Well, I think for them, the economic piece is what's driving their vote. Like that's the only thing that would make sense. But those are, there are, I think, within that group of voters, there are people who would peel off at some point, right? And that's why the suppression piece in terms of keeping those folks home is really important.
This is not a new phenomenon. I mean, it's obviously been intensified and it's been advanced and tailored because of social media and our current times. But like, bad leaders, bad behavior always generates its own bell curve of marking. Like, it just does, right? So you look, you can go back to the 1930s in Ontario with Mitch Hepburn, who spent half of the year in Florida and was drunk all the time. And let
sorry for my Mr. Mom reference, by the way.
Oh, but I'm just saying, like, this goes back like 90 years. And people are like, well, that's what we expect of Mitch. But, you know, like, when the lights come on and it's debate time, he'll be good, you know, and maybe he's shit faced and, you know, chasing secretaries around the desk and acting like a pig. But, you know, he sort of shows up at campaign time and you know, you can't expect anything more or less out of him. And the same thing goes, you know, like Rob Ford, well, you know, you sort of, this is what you expect of him. And so those people are able to purchase license that's unavailable to other candidates. And that's just the way it rolls. It's never a head-to-head comparison. And if you're going to make fitness for office and character an issue, then not only do you need to make it overwhelmingly, as Corey said, but you then also, I think, have to extend it and link it to an issue set and say, and this is the connection between them being lousy or untrustworthy or unfit and what it will mean to you. Because you don't need to give a fuck if somebody interesting and funny and goofy and offensive is in office. You only need to if you think that means you're not going to get something that you need.
But what constitutes unfit? And there's different definitions of that to different voters. And I think a lot of Albertans, if it's on that economic narrative and they're comparing Notley to Smith, they're going to say it's Notley is the one that's unfit because they feel like she's going to be, you know, leaning towards allies in Ottawa and environmental groups and
those are issue differences. People will always justify. Yeah. But listen, Smith is an outlier as a leader. Yeah, she's an outlier.
But she's a lunatic. I think you're going a little far there. But the she is someone on a number of issues, and I think the NDP war room's been good on picking this up, that stands with a fringe minority of folks on some pandemic measures and things like that. Like, that's where she's out of step. I think she's in lockstep with most Albertans in terms of what constitutes a provincial interest in around the economy and the energy sector. I think she's the one who's in the mainstream there. Notley is the one that is the outlier who's for typical voters are going to side with Smith on that, and all the polling going into this showed strong issue advantage for the UCP on the economy. Not a big surprise there. So, you know, insofar as the debate was more about the economy than other things, to the extent that Smith looked stable and measured and well spoken, it should be fairly smooth sailing to the victory party for the UCP is my view.
I always remember when my doctor said to me about Rob Ford, you know, it's a real shame about the crack because he's really keeping taxes down.
Well, if you're going to run on personal foibles and appropriateness for office, you got to find a candidate that's better than George Smitherman if you're going to strike a good comparison.
So, Corey, If you're running Smith, what do you do for the last week? Put her in remote rural Alberta where nobody can find her, or what?
I would do a tour of the front line of the forest fires and do premier like stuff where you look like a fucking asshole reporter if you bring up the latest daily attack from the NDP war room because you're there talking very seriously about things that are very premier like and I don't know. Maybe find some other things like that. Go visit a children's hospital or something. Something where you'd have to be absolutely the biggest dick in the world to talk politics at.
But we can't forget, there's also, of course, Get Out the Vote. And Alberta's starting the Vote Anywhere, which is happening on Tuesday. So, that you know, I think that that's going to be huge, too. And the NDP does have a strong focus on that Get Out the Vote push, which will be a saving grace if there is one, I think.
Look, at worst, this thing is neck and neck, right? And so that probably advantages the UCP in a bunch of ways, but like it's not over. I want to add one
thing. We also did agree at the beginning of this campaign that we thought the NDP had a better Calgary ground game.
Yeah.
I think that's still true. But, you know, you can be the fastest rower in the world, and you're not going to row your canoe in faster than the tide's going out, right? So at some, in some times. So, like, it depends. Like, I do think they have better ground game. I think there's lots of indications of that. I think, you know, Jordan, you've laid out the case pretty compellingly in past chats around this. But if you don't have any momentum going into that, it's really tough to have your ground game make the difference. And you know, but maybe that's a better use for the NDP's time in this next week, is to just go and drive a get out the vote message as hard as you can every day and try to get your folks out there.
They need oxygen.
Can I add one
more? They need oxygen, man.
For sure, they do. Can I add one more, just sort of general thought? Because I think there's a. This is a really fascinating case study when it comes to making core strategic decisions, which, you know, people like us talk about these things and, you know, after the fact, we armchair them and make it seem like, well, the right decisions were so plainly obvious and the wrong decisions were so plainly stupid. But, like, it's a big, like, let's say you're the NDP and, you know, to take Corey's point about what is the swim? Well, the swim is the economic future of Alberta and how do you stand up for the provincial interest and all of that. And you look at the data that's available to you if you're the NDP campaign at the outset of it. And you, and your data says, stay off of the economy. If you win a Monday on the economy, you're losing the week because that's not your issue set, right?
Yep.
Second, there is lots of room to work with in terms of reminding people that she's not fit for office. And we know that we've got some videotape and audio that's going to prove that and drive media. And third, we're strong on health. So you look at that and you go, so let's stay away from the economy. Let's punch away on healthcare and let's war room the living piss out of them. And you kind of go, okay, well, that's how we're going to build our strategy. And we're going to make the ballot question ourselves. But then you have to think strategically and ask yourself, is that a fully formed? That's our real estate. But is that real estate actually large enough?
No, that's the point. That's the point, Scott.
And it's that's the economy. Challenge. You're going to have some beat on the economy or disqualify her on the economy. It's not just enough to disqualify her while she said crazy stuff. But then, like, well, why then can't she? Which is why I think the CPP is maybe a bridge. Yeah. I just think. But it's hard, man, because you got to go, well, fuck, then I've got to take the risk of talking about the economy.
Yeah. Oh, it's too late. It's a little late.
I'm talking about broad terms. I'm not talking about now, Corey. I think there's an opportunity. The point he's making that I agree with
is that you can't win an election if the general consensus is that you're worse than your opponents on managing the economy. You can't win in that circumstance.
Yeah.
It's hard to campaign around the economy, period.
Yeah,
particularly in times like this,
there is an opportunity still for them to marry the raccoons in Daniel Smith's head and some of the economic issues in this closing argument. Like, Daniel Smith just stood up on national television and lied to Albertans about breaking the law in that ethics report. Okay, so what else is she lying about with respect to your pension? What else is she lying about with respect to doctors and hospitals and privatization? There's a whole opportunity there that you can bring those together as you make that final case to voters. And I think that that's what they're going to have to do in this next week.
Tell your folks to take a look at the closing ad of the 2004 campaign. Here's what we know about Stephen Harper so far. What don't we know? Right?
Is that the one where you start talking about soldiers in the streets?
No, that's not soldiers in the streets.
That was 2006. You're not supposed to bring that up. You're not supposed to bring that up.
I have to say, I feel like Corey's ears must be burning this week. No one has ever been cited as much as Corey this week in the aftermath of the debate with respect to low expectations for Danielle Smith.
Exactly. So every few years, big companies stage a comprehensive public reveal for the people who analyze and buy their stock. In attendance are a group of gimlet-eyed experts from financial institutions who dissect the presentations and write detailed reports that are taken very seriously indeed by investors worldwide. These analysts are effectively multi-billion dollar influencers, and they are notoriously difficult people to impress. They're numbers wonks, indifferent to spin, consumed by metrics. Heaven help the CEO who tries to dress up mediocre performance with a rosy PowerPoint deck. Anyway, our sponsor, CN, just held its investors event, and the analysts responded with glowing reports, impressed by two things in particular: CN's intensely disciplined focus on customer service and its potential for growth in a patchy post-pandemic economy. I've talked here before about CN's absolute insistence that its trains depart and arrive on time. That's the plan, and the plan is sacred. But you have to keep filling trains with cargo. The economy is shifting, and businesses that don't seek new sources of business will be left behind. For CN, that means setting up new supply chains for electric vehicles, transporting critical minerals necessary for batteries from mines to refineries, from refineries to factories, and eventually electrified cars from factories to consumers. It means moving liquid natural gas and timber out of northern BC to markets here and abroad. It means extending CN's reach beyond Canada and the US deep into Mexico. And it means spending money on new trains, technology, and infrastructure, several billion dollars a year. It's an aggressive growth agenda, but there's a worrying obstacle: new federal legislation that will impose expensive, anti-competitive new rules on shipping cargo. Railways will be forced to operate with one foot on the gas and the other on the brake. CN wants to create and expand supply chains. The federal government appears to have something else in mind. All right, let's move on, because time is running on us. Let's move on. And Rob Benzie and Rob Ferguson, our buds in the Toronto Star, had a piece last week that went something like this. Premier Doug Ford says Ontario will sweeten the pot to keep the $5 billion Stellantis LG Energy Solution electric vehicle battery plant in Windsor, but won't say how much. I will confirm we're putting more money on the table, Ford said Friday in St. Catharines. The future of the plant has been in limbo after the companies halted construction Monday as they seek subsidies to match ones given to Volkswagen for its EV battery plant in St. Thomas. Since then, all eyes have been on Ottawa and Queen's Park for a next move, with Federal Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne urging the Ontario government to make sure they pay their fair share. Sources speaking confidentially in order to freely discuss deliberations told the Star that provincial and federal officials have been locked in crisis talks for days aimed at clearing the impasse. It is believed Ottawa is considering concessions that would make it easier for Queen's Park to do preliminary work on the proposed 60-kilometer Highway 413 linking Milton to Vaughan in exchange for additional provincial funding. Okay, team, this thing has me so confused. How did the governments not anticipate, if not know, that Stellantis would be watching the VW deal and want similar terms? They seem surprised by that. Then there's negotiating between the two governments in public when we know they're talking privately constantly and have a pretty good relationship on these things and are likely to come to an agreement. So I don't know what that was all about. And what does Highway 413 in the name of all that's holy and Stephen Guilbeault have to do with the Stellantis plant? Just to give Corey a breather, Scott, do you want to start us off?
Well, I mean, this is awkward because Corey knows a bunch of stuff, presumably, and we don't. But I would say the answer to your last question, I think, is the most interesting one, right? Like, how'd the 413 get onto the table? I assume that the Ford guys were clever enough to put it on the table and go, hey, listen, you know? I don't know. If you want to talk turkey, here's an idea, right? And that's awkward for the feds, right? They're kind of like, okay, someone send Guilbeault out of the room, but like, all right, is that what it's going to take? In general terms, I think this is so fascinating because you have to ask yourself, like, what exactly went on here where you didn't think that the VW deal was naturally going to create a corresponding demand from Stellantis? Well, the answer is they did. They must have known that. They must have been conscious of it. And so then what happened? I think in part, Stellantis kind of went, I think, atypically nuclear, right? They just kind of went public and just go like, hey, we're going to like start like just putting you know, EV guns to people's heads. And so, okay, fine, you do that. And then the governments are scrambling and they're on their act together, particularly the feds and all that kind of stuff. But the feds are not wrong to say, well, Jesus Christ, if we're going to be ransomed up, then the province needs to be ransomed up as well. And so you're dancing around. But this is the game we're in now when it comes to corporate industrial strategy. Like, if you're going to say everybody, you know, if you go Oprah, you get a car and you get a car, then everybody's going to say, well, I actually had a car before, but now if you're handing out cars, I'd like an upgrade. And so this is the challenge it's going to be. So they better be successful in building a, you know, a full-on sector, because the amounts that are going to get paid are not justifiable on the basis of actual headcount of FTE. You've got, it only works if you build something that is a decades long, like literally like a brand new sector that sustains for time and time and time. And they're in a very precarious place, because now with the narrative that's established, anybody with jobs and plants in their pocket can walk up and say, if you don't give me everything I ask for, then you're fucking this strategy and it won't work. And you're saying no to your own industrial strategy and narrative, which you've just beckoned all over the place.
Well, then what amount of money would you say no to? Like, what is the metric that they are employing for when and money's appropriate and when it's too much? Like, how would one even know?
And you don't want to establish a framework in public, because then you say, well, I'm going to give away my negotiating leverage, except you don't really have negotiating leverage. As we see, if somebody decides to play hardball, they can say, I want it all. I want the corner lot. I want the cottage. I'm taking full custody of the kids, and you are fucked.
Well, I'm familiar with that kind of negotiation, but it's on a different topic. But
so skills will serve you well, Corey.
Well, look, I think that it's not a. I don't think it was a surprise at all around Stellantis for anyone. VW, I think when Stellantis first sort of negotiated this, IRA was a little more amorphous, and VW didn't have a deal. And I think they just had a more general commitment that we'll match IRA and, you know, and details to follow. And so, you know, I don't think it's either the province or the feds that were really putting this in the media and going after each other. I think it was Stellantis that put it in the media as a negotiating tactic, as you discussed. I don't think this extends to everything everywhere. I think IRA is focused on not everything in the economy, but things around green jobs and batteries and EVs and all of those sorts of things. So there is a bit of a ring fence. Canada and Ontario, or Canada and Quebec, or Canada and any other province can't match the U.S. Treasury in a program that's that broad. You got to kind of pick and choose areas to focus on, and clearly Ontario and the federal government have focused on EV manufacturing, particularly batteries, as sort of the most important component. And so I think it's focused on that. There's two companies with deals now. There's maybe enough room to do one more. You know, what does that look like? Well, there's always going to be an argument between the province and the federal government around cost sharing, but there's some pretty clear examples out there around autos in the past as to what that looks like. So if you look at the last two auto pacts, you know, you have a pretty good working framework. And, you know, I anticipate that all of this stuff is going to get settled in a similar way. You know, we'll see. Over the coming days.
There's not going to be a plant in Quebec, Corey?
I don't think there can be a plant in Quebec, and there's a couple of reasons. One, they don't have the workers, and the provincial government there is you know, nationalist government with a heavy vein of xenophobia running through it when it comes to allowing immigrants into the province. They only use about 25% of their allotment. Whereas, you know, Ontario would use 200% of
theirs. Yeah, but Jesus Christ, it feels to me like if you've put 25 or 30 billion federal dollars into building up the auto industry in Ontario, and you don't do anything in Quebec, I mean, that's Blanchet's speech for the whole campaign, isn't it?
Well, there really isn't much of an auto industry in Quebec, and there hasn't been for some time. The second thing that they're short of is energy. Yeah, and in winter months, they're importing energy from Ontario. Like, So yeah, I think there's a lot.
Those are compelling arguments, Corey. But isn't David's point fundamental? I mean, you're talking about the narrowest of terms.
That's
going to be regional jealousies. Alberta and Quebec are going to say we want tons of money. BC says us too. If you're putting up $30 billion for one province, then we're going to want to share that's similar. And you're not talking about the integrated supply chain. So what about the Ring of Fire? What about the mining industry? So there's more money to come there in terms of actually making every rung on that ladder sturdy. So like it takes you into, and I'm not arguing against it, I'm just saying jeepers creepers, the politics of this and the implicit demands that it opens you up to, for which you have very little political shielding. Wow, it's big dollars. Well, baby,
but look, no amount of federal or provincial money is gonna get an auto manufacturing facility built in Regina. Like, it's just, you know, there are things that are true.
Boost us on, you know, we need agri-science stuff or whatever, right? So just sign us a check for $15 billion. We'll figure out something to put it toward.
Sure. But, you know, this is about matching the IRA, and that's mostly around certain activities that are more likely going to be done in zones with heavy manufacturing industries. And look, while Southwestern Ontario has been battered, beaten, and bruised in that sector over the past 20 years, it's still many orders of magnitude larger than what has ever existed in Quebec and ever will exist in Quebec in terms of those jobs. But at the end of the day, for a lot of these things, and this is why I think it didn't get as much press as the article that you mentioned around the 413, but the Ring of Fire is clearly a part of this agreement in this deal. And that's because without the critical minerals being mined, there are no battery plants. There are no EV manufacturing facilities. Like, those two things are tied together, not through politics, but through the actual, you know, value chain and supply chain of what you need to do to build these vehicles. So you're going to want the plants located close to where those heavy minerals are. You don't want to move heavy stuff long distances many times if you want to keep your costs down. So you're going to see, I think, a big focus on critical minerals. That is, you know, clear in the last federal budget. You know, everyone's on board with it except the environment minister. And
What about the indigenous groups in the area, Corey? There's been $1 billion on the table for a decade just to build a fucking road to that place, and nobody can agree on building a road.
But I you're seeing those environmental assessment process, it's being led by First Nations around the mine, and so there's a lot of progress that's being made around that. Road's not going to get built without those agreements in place, and I think you're going to have those agreements in place. It won't be done without environmental assessments being completed. But here's where there's, you know, a choice for the federal government. Do you mirror that whole process a second time at the federal level, or do you say, you know, we'll accept the provincial EAs that are working through as acceptable for their process and actually speed the thing up? So I think that's the direction that's going in, because to get the green jobs of the future, you need to get the new minerals that need to be mined in order to do that. So everyone seems to understand that, once again, except the environment minister. And, you know, summer is a great time for a cabinet shuffle. That's all I'll say.
Hey, Jordan, what is your take on all this? Because I do think that regional politics of this are difficult.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that any federal government has to watch that and look at balancing your industrial policy across the country. But there are going to be different industries that are different and areas of focus in different regions. And so for the auto industry right now in Ontario, this is really a generational opportunity. And so I think the feds in the province were right and had no choice. That when Stellantis held the gun to their head, they had to pony up. We're talking about a significant number of jobs. More than that, it is the linchpin of this entire EV strategy. So if you let this piece collapse, the whole thing comes down. So I don't think they had a lot of choice here. And I think that looking down the road, they're going to need to come up with offers in other provinces that support key industries there. Maybe not to the same magnitude, because I think you can make a case that what's happening in the auto industry right now, this isn't something that comes once every 2 or 3 years. This is truly generational, and the sums of money reflect that. But I would just say too, like, I think I want to be really clear. I think that politically, it was absolutely the right choice to step in and save this. I think part of the weirdness of the optics around the public negotiation and the awkwardness of the last few weeks is that the feds threw themselves a ticker tape parade for getting this done when it was not actually, in fact, done. So being a little quick to roll out the mission accomplished banner has bit them here, because instead of being able to claim this as kind of a clean win in terms of jobs and having, you know, one of those core pieces in place after the Volkswagen deal, they're seeming to be scrambling. But one of the other things that I think we have to watch long-term on this politically is when these kinds of checks are cut, you can't just cut the check and hope for the best, right? There's not a great history of that, even within the auto sector. We can think even recently of Windsor Third Shift, Oshawa, you know, Nemac, like all of these various places where there's been investment, be it from the province or the feds, and subsequently those jobs have disappeared and people have pulled out. So, you know, making sure that it's coming with job guarantees, making sure that it's coming with a long-term relationship with these companies that have long-term guarantees. And that's also part of an overall strategy. And so I would also make the pitch too that you don't need just an industrial strategy. You don't need just an EV strategy. You need a new federally inflected, working with the Ontario and auto strategy. You need to really name that, and you need to be clear with voters about what the ultimate outcomes are going to be on this, and not just in sort of esoteric terms, but what does this look like over a generation when we get these lines here in Canada that they're here for 30, 40, 50 years, and those jobs and those outcomes that people can really take home. So I think that there's an opportunity there for the feds to tell a much better story about what they're being forced to do now. They could turn it into a little bit more of a virtue. And I think as a caution, as they look forward, transparency is also going to be an important piece of this. Right now, necessarily, a lot of this is behind closed doors because not all of the negotiation can happen in public. But that can also be a breeding ground of discontent as we look down the road. So they need to think really carefully about how they can map out publicly what the path is on this, what the investments are yielding, and exactly what guarantees they're going to get so that you don't have a situation where people feel like companies have taken the money and left.
So, you know, it does not feel to me like the government has a whole of Canada strategy about this. And, you know, I mean, there's enough Western genetics in me that I just react instinctively, to be honest, about how fucking convenient it is that the same circumstance that requires shutting down Western Canada's key industry is a huge opportunity for Ontario industry, especially if feathered with a lot of federal money that Ontario, I mean, it just seems so Canadian to me about how this is all going down.
Yeah, well, I mean, in fairness, I think the feds would like to feather Alberta with money, but they need a willing partner who wants to do it on their political terms, and they have not had that.
No amount of federal money will ever offset the role that the energy industry plays in the economy of the province, which is, you know, circle back to not only the fundamental problem with that narrative, but look, I hear what you say on regional fairness, and there's going to be, I think, a lot of other things the federal government's going to have to do around, especially electrical generation and transmission grids and all of that. And they put on the table $80 billion through this ITC program to do that kind of stuff. So I think you're going to see tens of billions of dollars going into other provinces and in these areas. But, you know, manufacturing, you know, we can bemoan it as, you know, I certainly have in the past, in terms of the inability to get that established very well in other parts of the country. But the reality is we haven't, you know, and so where is that going to happen? It's going to happen where it's always happened. So Southwestern Ontario will be ground zero for that stuff. Trying to find things for to balance that equation in other areas can be helped or hurt by the provincial governments there and the policies and approach they choose to take. But, you know, look, what I'd say to Quebec is if, you know, you're short of energy and you're short of workers, it's hard to be long on getting new jobs. Like, short, long doesn't work. You know, short, and short. That's what happens. So, you know,
sure, we can find a few more ships to be built in Quebec. Sure, we can do that.
Well, yeah, you know, we don't seem to be excelling very well in that area in terms of it. But that is actually a good example, right? Like the shipbuilding contracts of, you know, there is shipbuilding in Ontario, Heddle Shipyards, but the federal money in that area has gone to Quebec and Davie. It's gone to C-SPAN. It's gone to Irving. Like it's. These are, you know, so you're going to build ships on the ocean. You're going to build factories in southwestern Ontario. You know, you're going to do more resource stuff on the prairies. Like the geography and all of those things do play a factor in it.
I would just add one quick last thing, and that is Stellantis may have thought it had everybody's balls in their fist, and so they decided to squeeze. But there's a chance that they also squeezed the golden electrification goose, because the fact that we're having this discussion, others are having this discussion, and it really highlights not just the regional disparity of executing on this policy, which might not be quite as loud and quite as face front if Stellantis hadn't played its cards the way it had, if it had taken this to the front of the newspapers instead of behind in the boardrooms. And then secondly, it really highlights the awkwardness of corporate subsidies of an industrial policy. And it's got to be tempting over the last 6-7 weeks for a Pierre Poilievre, you know, who's leading in the polls and is 18 months, 24 months from competing to be prime minister of the country, to look at this and pursue his own natural inclination to say, well, actually, I'm going to play off of those regional grievances and give them voice. And I'm going to play into my own natural hesitation to use the federal treasury as a piggy bank for the likes of major multinational corporations. And so Stellantis may be happy with itself right now, but there's a risk that it's kicked off a debate that's going to actually, you know, literally put this thing onto jeopardy as a matter of overall macro strategy. So, you know, penny wise and pound foolish, short-term gain, long-term jeopardy.
All right, guys, we're going to move on now to our last topic. And I'm giving Corey and Scott notice that we're going to be looking to them for some pithy advice here. So David Johnston preview, he's going to say something tomorrow, apparently. There's two scenarios. Surely the most likely one is that he recommends an inquiry and provides some terms of reference for such an inquiry. Unlikely is he recommends against an inquiry and gives reasons. We can get to that, but let's take the likely scenario first. An inquiry is going to be a regular shit show for the government. Accusations of cover-ups as information is withheld because it can't be revealed publicly, combined with bits of information that lack context but seem alarming, surprising testimonies, all these things. So we have two gentlemen. We're lucky enough to have two gentlemen who have managed such things, Gomery in the case of Scott and Duffy in the case of Corey. So if you're the government, how do you set up and manage this beast?
With great difficulty, for the reasons that you mentioned. Like, this is why I've always said I think an inquiry will be very unsatisfying for most people, for the reasons that you stated. Like, I think these fights are always difficult. It's always difficult to manage these processes, but it's triply so when you can't talk about the details of stuff. So we saw another one of these this past week with another Fife Chase story out saying that that Bill Blair had been sitting on warrant requests for months, and Bill Blair comes out and says...
Only 4 months.
Yeah, okay. And Blair comes out and says, I can't talk about this at all. I can't share anything, but, you know, you guys are fucking liars. And, you know, without any supporting proof or backup, that just looks like a convenient thing for him to say that doesn't seem terribly credible, right? So, like, take that episode of the past week and multiply it forward over however many months inquiry is going to go. If they say it's a 6-month inquiry, you can probably take to the bank that it'll be 10, maybe 12. But, you know, you're going to be spending, if not a year, the better part of a year with this this low grade fever and other terrible symptoms of an ailment that you, for which there is no cure. So I think it's bad. I think, you know, But this has been a long time coming. I think the mistake and the miss on this was, and continues to be, not being aggressive enough in terms of addressing the problem, and being dragged almost kicking and screaming, and past the point of getting any credit for it, for any changes that you do make. So, you know, you throw out the Chinese diplomat who's threatening a Canadian MP's family, you know, which is the right decision, but you do it after a week of humming and hawing over it, and not only don't get any credit, it looks like you were shamed into doing it. So, yeah, I think that's a challenge. I think they got to get way more aggressive on the solution side of this if they want to have any reasonable chance of coming through it all right. But the fundamental things that you talked about are the problem, and I don't think there's an easy solution to it.
But Scott, I think Corey has hit on something really important, which is the need for the government to appear to be as interested in the truth as anybody else is, which it hasn't appeared to be to date.
That's right. And that's why I'm going to defy your construct and say, no matter what Johnson recommends, they should announce there's going to be an inquiry. If Johnson recommends it because he's found a bunch of very precise, I'm going to be super Laurentian lead about it. And I don't think that actually, if you look at the systems, that they require any improvement or change, and everything seems like it's actually, there's suspenders and belts all over the place. I think the government says, yeah, but this is an issue of fundamental public confidence. And the discussion has been broad enough that we have to reassure people, and therefore an independent examination will provide that assurance. And that's an opportunity for them to actually re-seize the narrative and say, see, we actually do give a shit. I think they need to do three or four things. And I don't think that Gomery is the relevant comparator for us, David. People forget that we also appointed the O'Connor inquiry. And I think that's the appropriate comparator for a couple of reasons. First, it actually also dealt with national security.
I forgot how many people were looking into us.
We're so well earned.
People will go, oh, so well earned. You fucking morons. You guys kept calling commissions all over the place. And I would just be very careful that you don't, your political decisions aren't based on the last war rather than the next war. Gomery hangs over the Liberal Party as a precedent, and hangs over you and me, David, and, you know, in a particular way. But the truth of the matter was, the O'Connor inquiry told you that you can actually do this in a way that's managed and structured. So first of all, if I was the government, move fast. Okay. You want it to start fast and you want it to end fast. Now, you may not be able to dictate exactly when it's going to end, but you want it well over, you know, you want this thing done the next 6 to 12 months. You don't want this thing to go on and on and on and on. And you don't want it to move into bumping up against an electoral cycle. Second, pick an O'Connor, not a Gomery. Gomery was a shitty judge, let's be honest. And he played his cards very poorly on a bunch
of. We had trouble getting a judge to do that. Francis Fox couldn't find a Quebec judge that wanted to do that inquiry.
That is an absolute truth, right? Whereas O'Connor was an incredibly capable, thoughtful, thorough person, reached what actually are quite startling conclusions and recommendations around the conduct of the RCMP in particular, and the former commissioner, but was able to navigate the need to provide public answers with the need to ensure that there was respect for national security and that which must remain confidential, and our Five Eyes partners and so on and so forth. So one, move fast. Two, appoint somebody that is good and that is demonstrably good. And then I think third, they've got to pick up a page from Corey's playbook, which is don't just let that inquiry be the answer, right? Also be playing cards on this, right? So do expel diplomats and do take initiatives and do use the G7 meeting that we just had to greater leverage on this domestic issue in terms of demonstrating that you're being tough on China at the G7, which is something I'm going to get to in my Hey You. And so I think that you can, I don't think that it is, the conventional wisdom is that if there's an inquiry, it elevates this issue. I actually think it's one of the ways you might insulate yourself from a daily barrage of Bob Fife stories, Steve Chase stories, and from the drip, drip, drip that you can't control, from things that are true and things that aren't true, things that are shaded, things that aren't shaded. And so I think you move no matter what Johnson says, and you do it fast, you do it credibly. And I don't know that it has to be with certainty the political gauntlet that people suggest that it absolutely automatically will be.
Jordan, do you have any concluding thoughts on this before we wrap up on how the government ought to proceed with Johnson and just
You have a thought. You have a thought.
I'll save it for later.
Just say it. Okay, so I have a political career miraculously blessed by a complete absence of being inquired into, which is great. You know, goes along with not winning government federally, apparently.
I was going to say.
I speak from a position of great experience. But listen, here's what I'm going to talk about. I think Scott's exactly right. The answer is inquiry, regardless of whatever Johnson reports. They're toast if they don't. They're dead. So they have to get ready to make that call and make it quickly. Speed, I think, as Scott has articulated so well, is of the essence. I think that the thing about the inquiry is that it's not going to be worse than the drip drip and the constant reaction and derailment that they're experiencing right now. So yes, it's not desirable in a vacuum, but we're not in a vacuum. We're in a situation where these leaks have been wagging the dog for this government now for almost 4 months. So this actually would give them a measure of control and at least a channel of where those things are going to go. So first thing I would say is that the prime minister needs to grab hold of the narrative and look active instead of reactive. And so both Corey and Scott have talked about some of the ways in which he could do that. I would throw another on the table. Like, it's still not a criminal offense to engage in foreign interference. Like, why? Like, this could be done quickly. That could be, you know, bring forward that legislation. Get on some of those little pieces that make you look like you're actually caring about this. Because at this point, the most energy we've seen out of the Liberals on this issue was when they were trying to prevent Katie Telford from being forced to testify. That is the most energy and organization we've seen from them on this, and that is bad. So we need to see Trudeau up there and leading the charge on transparency and on action on this. So that's the first piece of advice I would give. And then the second piece of advice goes to where I do have experience, and that is, get your own house in order. Know what's going on internally. There are going to be questions about who knew what in the Liberal Party and when. This national security advisor business about when threats were known or not known and who they got past to, all of this will come out in the wash. So you have got to know the answer to those questions now, and you need to make any changes necessary internally quickly. So I hope and pray that there is somebody who is on that, because otherwise that could be a huge area of liability for them. And then lastly,
sounds like the Liberal Party may have to come to a point of view about Michael Chan at some point.
Yes, I think that is probably unavoidable at this point. And then I think that the last thing is that when they go forward with an inquiry, it would be wise to make it broader. This is not just about election interference, but this is about foreign interference more broadly in Canadian democratic processes. And that can include that's the harassment of Chinese Canadians, that's the police stations, that's all of this network also of funding that's going to universities and, yes, the Trudeau Foundation and all of the rest of it. Like, you need to hug all of those issues into this basket as a way to channel and contain them. And those are my thoughts.
Great. Excellent. Do you think we ever get back to a point where it is considered bad form to leak intelligence to the media?
I hope so, because I think this is a terrible precedent, to be honest. I think it's bad for us as a country. I think it's bad with our allies. I think this is not how policy should be made, for sure.
If you're a spy and you're leaking to the media, it's time to find a new profession, because that's mutually exclusive. Everyone can be frustrated with different things, but there are ways to whistleblow within government and to move things forward that don't involve leaking intelligence information to the public. It's bad, irrespective of who's in office.
Yeah, an act of ego, for sure.
Yep. All right, Scott, do you got a hey you? Wait, Mr. Pinsent, please summon us.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The hey yous are about to begin.
All right, Scott, you got a hey you?
Yeah, as I hinted, my hey you is actually about the G7 and what it had to say with respect to China. And, you know, you just kind of get the feeling that China is too big to fail. Like, that's kind of like, you know, it's sort of like, is this 2009? Are we talking about a bank? Because the world leaders came together and said, hey, quit screwing around on our democracies. right? Play according to some kind of international-based system of rules. Mind yourselves. It's too much. But Jesus H. Christ, your economy's big, and I don't know how to disentangle. And so, like, we're going to continue to work with you where we can and where we must and where you've got us by the short ones. And I just think, you know, you can really feel the discomfort and almost the sense, if you read between the lines, of helplessness, that we made this bet 25 years ago on the economic liberalization of China, what that would mean in terms of global trade, assuming that where economic reforms went, democratic reforms would follow. That turned out to be dead dog fucking wrong. And so now they're having trouble figuring out how do we build an alternative? How do we punish a bad player? And it's, you know, the Americans, it's not like you can kind of go, okay, well, let's just treat it like a Latin American country and we'll just have regime change. There's no banana republic. They can't just, you know, send in black ops and, you know, and just install a puppet dictator. This is China. And I don't think the world has figured it out. Obviously, Canada hasn't figured it out. But I do know this. If you were going to at least issue the first part of that statement at the G7, Canada should have made a lot more domestic noise around the fact, given what's going on here, around the fact that it was condemning China and telling it to play by some kind of rules. Did not seem like that was a point of emphasis for the government. Maybe it felt like with Johnson coming up, it was a point of sensitivity and vulnerability. I don't know. I think it has to seize on chances like that and say, we're actually shaping this in our favor rather than just ignoring it.
I would encourage everybody, it's a good AU, and I would encourage everybody to check out a New York Times article from last week, which pretty compellingly laid out the case that the Western world cannot build the number of electric cars we are legally committed to using in the time frame in which we are legally committed to using them. That China has such a stranglehold over the electric vehicle supply chain that if we want to drive electric cars, we're going to be driving Chinese-made electric cars.
Well, this is why we need the Ring of Fire. This is what all of that stuff's about. Can I go next?
You can go next.
I have a little recommendation on the front end of this because you were talking about CIA, black ops, etc. For all the politicos listening, if you want a good watch, tune into the White House Plumbers on Crave. It's pretty good, you know. G. Gordon Liddy, very, very funny.
Not even older than funny, Mr. Mom.
Yeah, I know. It's great. Anyway, well worth watching. So my Hey You is to the PMO and the Trudeau government. This seems like such obvious advice. I hope it doesn't sound too insulting putting it out there. But after the past few months, I feel like it needs to be said anyway. You're going to get probably a recommendation for an inquiry. Before you name who's going to head it up, make sure they don't have a neighboring cottage to the Prime Minister. Make sure they are not currently or have ever been on the board of the Trudeau Foundation. Like, these all seem like fairly obvious things to say, but they seem to need to be said anyway. Because
Commissioner Aga Khan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no one who's private plane you've ridden on or vacation property you've stayed at, or, you know, it's a substantial list. But, you know, I think it needs to be said, because at the end of this is going to be a painful thing for everyone to have to go through. We're going to suffer through many news stories on this long past the point of it really being that interesting for most folks. So let's at least have it be effective and have it be credible. And effective means credible. And it's not going to be credible if it's a friend, family member, or, you know, close associate of the Prime Minister or his family.
All right, so Sasha Trudeau's off the list.
How'd it go?
Be like that, Corey. Bob Gainey would be a good choice.
Why not Alan Rock?
I mean, you know, yeah.
He's a lawyer, isn't he? Sort of a lawyer. I don't know. Bob Ray? Is Bob Ray still alive?
Jordan, you got to hate you?
I do. So my Hey You this week is going out to the chief electoral officer. So that's Stéphane Perrault, who, I don't know if you guys saw this, but he was at committee last week talking about the idea of expanded voting days. So this is in the conference and supply agreement, the notion that maybe we move from one election day to having three election days as a way to help increase turnout. And And Stefan Perro's response to this was like, basically, go suck an egg. We can't find enough staff to do one election day. So if you decide to go to three election days, we're going to have to cut polling locations by 25 to 40%. And my hey you is going out to him because you have one fucking job. Your job is to increase voter turnout. It is to ensure electoral integrity. And that sounds like a you problem. If we don't have enough people to manage one election day in Canada, the response is not, well, we shouldn't do more when we're looking at a situation where we had a near historic low voter turnout in our last election. We have like all these signs of democratic decay and declining engagement. And you're telling us that you can't figure out a way to find more polling clerks so that we can maybe reverse that trend and improve the health of our democracy. Please go the fuck home and think about your life, because this is absolutely not the way forward. And that is my hey you.
Hey, Scott. Despite your, given all of your mastery of dark language, there's still nothing better than go suck an egg, right?
Oh, yeah. Fucking no, great.
Go suck an egg.
Oh,
well,
man.
Done. Well done, Jordan. That was
very nice. Very nice. Had a beat up on the gatekeepers.
Exactly. All right. My hey you goes out to Rachel Notley, former Premier Notley. It is not too late. There is a week left in this campaign. I have seen lots of votes move in the last week of campaigns, enough to decide elections. This can still happen. Go out there and throw a punch hard. Don't fucking think that you can just do what you've been doing with more intensity and vigor. Do something different and hit them hard. It's still time. All right.
That's evergreen our show. Evergreen advice from Hurley and Reed. Mm. Fight, throw a punch, do something daring. Maybe you'll blow up, maybe you'll die, but you'll feel better about yourself and your bruised.
Yeah, numbers. don't just drift through the last week of the campaign hoping things had gone better, wishing things had gone better. Okay, great show today, you three. Thank you for being here, all three of you. Thank you, everybody who watched or listened to this show today. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. And, of course, we'll be back next week with more Curse of Politics. Until then, take care of yourselves.